Niebuhr, who was an American Reformed theologian and ethicist during the 1950s, said, "Nothing that is worth doing can be achieved in our lifetime. Therefore, we must be saved by hope. Nothing which is true or beautiful or good makes complete sense in any immediate context of history. Therefore, we must be saved by faith. Nothing we do, however virtuous, can be accomplished alone. Therefore, we are saved by hope, by love. No virtuous act is quite as virtuous from the standpoint of our friend or foe as it is from our standpoint. Therefore, we must be saved by the final form of love, which is forgiveness." Throughout this month, we will be exploring the theme of story together. And rather than a typical sermon on the power, the abuse, whose voice gets to tell a story, and so on and so forth, which of course we will have in soon Sundays to come, I want to offer you four stories today. Four stories for you to take home and consider for your heart, for your discernment, however it is that you need them today. Jen and I will be offering them to you. Stories on hope and faith and love and forgiveness. For they are, I know, our craved spiritual questions of the day and for our world.
Nothing that is worth doing can be achieved in our lifetime, therefore we must be saved by hope. These are the words of Eileen Carr. When I was growing up, I had a mom and a dad, and my dad stayed home to take care of me while my mom worked. At that time, I was an only child, since I didn't get a sibling until my 20s. So since I was the only kid, I spent a lot of time with my dad. We did everything together. We played music together, him on the flute and me on the piano and singing. We went to yard sales together, hoping to find treasures. And one of my favorite things that my dad and I did together was running errands. Do you ever run errands with your parents? What does running errands mean? To most people, running errands means going out to get the groceries, drop off the dry cleaning, pick up prescriptions at the drugstore, return books to the library, those kinds of things. But throughout my whole childhood, my dad and I ran a different type of errands. Every Saturday, we'd wake up early. He'd drive us to Krispy Kreme Donuts, where the hot light was always on, a neon sign outside signifying that hot and fresh donuts were ready for the choosing. My dad and I would buy 4 or 5 dozen donuts, and that's when we'd go run errands, which actually meant driving all around the town and bringing those delicious hot donuts to all our friends who had to work on Saturdays. We'd go to the gas station to see our friends there, the cashier in her 80s and all 5 of her children working there with her. We go to the florist, and then to a restaurant, and to a bar. Finally, of course, they sold pastries at the coffee shop, but not fresh, hot Krispy Kreme donuts. We'd share our donuts with all of the employees, drink our coffee, that was Dad, and hot chocolate, that was me. The manager would take me into the roasting room and show me how she roasted the beans for the coffee. My dad would eat donut after donut with the owner. We'd see old friends there and share our donuts with them too. So much of my childhood happened in that coffee shop. Misha's coffee shop has had a wonderful tradition throughout my entire lifetime. Every year on Christmas morning, amidst a sea of closed businesses, they open from 8 until noon, and everything in the store is free. The coffee, the hot cocoa, the cookies and bagels and orange juice, everything is free, and everyone comes in their pajamas. The coffee house is stuffed to the brim with revelers, celebrating a day off from work, celebrating the feeling of gathering in community, celebrating the birth of baby Jesus, celebrating how gosh darn good it feels to share, to receive, and to give love away, the shared world. Many years after I stopped running errands with my dad, when it was time to plan our wedding, my soon-to-be spouse and I knew where we'd be getting the coffee for our brunch reception. Misha's, of course. What a beautiful reminder of how important, how sacramental, really, it is to share with others. And isn't that what being married is really about? The Palestinian poet Naomi Shihab Nye wrote a beautiful poem called Gate A4 about meeting a Palestinian woman in an airport. She speaks no English and is in a state of acute panic, thinking that her flight has been canceled when really it's only been delayed. Naomi, also from Palestine, the land of Jesus' birth, calms the woman down and calls her family to let them know about the flight delay. Naomi's new friend, this older Palestinian lady, begins to warm up, telling jokes and sharing memories with Naomi. And then she takes out some delicious homemade cookies from her bag and goes all around the airport gate sharing them with everyone. Everyone, Naomi recalls, was covered in the same powdered sugar, laughing the same laughs, smiling the same smiles. Naomi wrote, "And I looked around that gate of late and weary ones and thought, this is the world I want to live in, the shared world. Not a single person in this gate, once the crying of confusion stopped, seemed apprehensive about any other person. Everyone took the cookies. I wanted to hug them all. This can still happen anywhere. Not everything is lost."
Come, come, whoever you are, wanderer, worshiper, lover of leaving, ours is no caravan of despair. Come, yet again, come.
Nothing which is true or beautiful or good makes complete sense in any immediate context of history. Therefore, we must be saved by faith. These are the words of Reverend Victoria Sackett. They had no idea where they were going when they left that night in the dark, without lights, without shoes, without bread, their children smothered against them so they wouldn't make noise. They had no idea what they were getting into following this Moses, this wild-eyed one who claimed visions and made promises, but who, after all, could guarantee them nothing except death if they were caught. They had no idea, these slaves, what it could mean, this promise of land, their own country and life abundant. Of freedom, they knew nothing, except what they could taste by living in its opposite, slavery. And that taste became a hunger, and that hunger became insatiable till they were ravenous for freedom, and they went out then. But no one knows to this day whether they were led by Moses or by the outstretched arm and mighty hand of something else or something eternal, as they would afterwards and always claim, or whether their own human hungry will made them flee that night from Pharaoh. They went into the wilderness. There they wandered for 40 years, which in those days was a lifetime. 40 was a good old age. So many of them died before getting anywhere. And many were born in the desert and grew to adulthood knowing nothing but the journey. Not slavery, not freedom, just the going. They whined and complained and muttered, and some mutinied, for they were a stiff-necked and rebellious people. You can read it for yourself. ungrateful people, even when the manna rained down from heaven and quails were sent to feed them, unhappy people, longing and loud even for the familiar security of Egypt, of all places where at least they knew what to expect, as awful as it was. Impatient people making cheap little idols and gods of metal to bargain with in secret when the traveling got hard and the days and years became monotonous. The promised land is not a destination. It is a way of going. The land beyond the Jordan, that country of freedom and dignity and laughter, you carry it inside you all the while. It is planted in your mind and heart already before you even start out, before it even occurs to you that in order to leave that life in Egypt, the intolerable bondage of that life, what you need to do is stand up and walk forward.
Come, come, whoever you are, wanderer, worshiper, lover of leaving. Ours is no caravan of despair. Come, yet again come.
Nothing we do, however virtuous, can be accomplished alone. Therefore, we are saved by love. Imagine with me that you're going along a trail in the woods in Vermont, and you come across a steep gorge with a river rushing at the bottom. There's only one way to get across. You see a bridge, and the bridge is made of grass. What I want to know is what questions would be running through your mind before you set foot on that grass bridge. What questions? What I would want to know more than anything else is if the people who made the bridge also walked across that bridge and whether they still use it. Now, we don't have bridges made of grass in New Jersey or Pennsylvania, but many were built for hundreds of years in South America by the Inca people, and I think a few still exist. Here's how they did it. First, they made fresh bridges once a year. On the appointed day, everyone in the village would gather to begin work. Each person had a special role to play in building the bridge. First, there were people who gathered the grass. Then other people took the grass and twisted it into long ropes. Then other people took those ropes and wove them into thick braids. And those braids were twisted by other people into long cables as thick as an arm. Then certain people strung the cables across the gorge and pulled them nice and tight. And finally, there were riggers who would lash the cables together in such a way as to create a footbed to walk on and rails on each side to hold. Each person did their part as best they could, and they relied on everyone else to do their part well because every one of them needed that bridge to safely carry them across the river whenever they needed to go that way. I tell you about grass bridges this morning for two reasons. First, it reminds us of how important our small part is when it's part of something big and strong and even miraculous, like a bridge made of grass. I have to say, I think it's miraculous that a bridge can be made of grass, and these bridges could span 60 feet. That's longer than the length of our sanctuary, and they could hold 5 people at a time, and llamas too. Second, we in this congregation may not be building a bridge across a raging river, but we are building a way toward our future, our shared vision. I want to walk that way. I hope many of you will walk that way too. And if I'm going to walk that way, I want to walk a way that feels sure and strong and safe, a way that I know has been built well, with everyone doing their part as best they can. So may we all build that way together like the Inca grass bridge builders.
Despair. Come yet again, come.
No virtuous act is quite as virtuous from the standpoint of our friend or foe as it is from our standpoint. Therefore, we must be saved by the final form of love, which is forgiveness. Now, before I read you the story, I need to say that with the world as it is today, I am not about to offer you a story out of naivety or irresponsibility. I'm not asking you to let go of the ugliness that abounds or the way you might feel wounded because of the world that is. That is not love, not love for our country, for our children, for our spirits. This is a story instead for the much smaller world in our hearts that also deserves a word of nourishment. And so it goes. In a land far away, a wise old man who knew a great deal about people because he traveled from place to place arrived at a strange village. In this town, all the people were carrying what seemed to be great bundles on their backs. Very well, they never looked up because of the heavy burdens they carried. Puzzled, the wise old man finally stopped a young fellow. "My good man, I am a stranger to your land and am fascinated by these large bundles you all carry about but never seem to put down. What is their purpose?" "Oh, these," answered the young fellow in a matter-of-fact way, "these are our grudges." "My," said the wise old man, "that's a lot of grudges to collect at your age." "Oh, they're not all mine. Most of them were passed down in my family." The young fellow heaved a weary sigh. "See that man over there? I have quite a load of grudges against his family. His great-great-grandfather called mine a horse thief when they both wanted to be elected mayor." The wise man looked around and shook his head sadly. "You all look so unhappy. Is there really no way to get rid of your burdens?" "We have forgotten how," said the young fellow, shifting his load a little. "You see, at first we were really proud of our grudges. Tourists came from miles around, but after a few years, Grudgeville became a dreary place. Nobody came, and we had forgotten how to stop holding our grudges." "If you really want to get rid of these grudges," said the wise old man, "I think I have 5 magic words that will do the trick." "You do? That would be a miracle. I'll go and have the mayor call the people of Grudgeville together," and off he went as fast as his grudges would let him. When the people had quieted down after gathering, the mayor said, "Good people of Grudgeville, a wonderful thing has happened. A very wise, strange stranger has come into our town. He says he can tell us the magic words that will rid us of these grudges. How many of you would like to be able to straighten up, have your grudges disappear, look at the world in a whole new way? Listen to the wise words of this visitor and let him tell you how." "My friends, these are simple words, yet some people find them hard to say. I think you have the courage to speak them. The trick is that you must say them to each other and truly mean them. The first 2 words are, 'I'm sorry.' Can you say them? The other 3 are, 'I forgive you.' Can you say that? Now say these words together." There was a long pause, then a low grumble from the townspeople. First one person and then another said the words. Soon they were all saying them to each other quietly at first and then louder. And then, would you believe it? Just like the wise man predicted, the grudges disappeared. What joy there was in the town. People were heard saying, "Look how those trees have grown, and is that you, Jim? How good to see your face."